This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I have the great pleasure of talking to Melanie Hoffert. She's the author of Prairie Silence, a memoir. It has a subtitle, A Rural Expatriate's Journey to Reconcile Home, Love, and Faith. How are you, Melanie?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Good. Now, this is your first book, correct?
It is, yes, my very first book, and I'm
so
excited.
Is this exciting? Yeah, I assume this is pretty exciting for you.
Yeah, a little unnerving, to be honest with you, but it's all very good, and I'm super happy to have the book in the world.
Well, I can kind of understand the unnerving quality because this is a very personal book, and you're really, I mean, it's very brave to talk about your life in, you know, in a memoir and really delve into the personal details of your life. So, you know, I commend you for that. I think it's really a remarkable thing to do. But I guess maybe that kind of leads to my first question. This is, and you know, just for people who are you know, won't be familiar with the book, you're from North Dakota, a small farming town where you grew up, where your family had been has been for quite a while. It's your family of farmers for the most part. And this is about a lot about your life growing up there, being, let's say, being lesbian and not being able to really have a context for a conversation about that. But really, it goes into much bigger things. It's about, when you say silence, you're talking about much larger ideas of what silence is for the people in the area where you grew up in and for your family. So I guess, you know, it this is part of your being to talk about this, but kind of, I guess I have to ask this question, like, what prompted you to start writing about your life?
Yeah, that's a good question. It definitely, my goal was never to write a book about my life. I think I have always just been a writer, been very drawn to the craft, and have felt the innate urge and need to write. And so when I would sit down to write, the things that would, you know, naturally be a part of what I was exploring were things that I was grappling with or dealing with, or things that I was very drawn to. And so as a part of that, there was the land that I grew up on and loved, but for, you know, reasons that you're raising, I felt very distant from as an adult because it was uncomfortable going back and being among the people. I, you know, I would write about this tension in my life where silence when I went home was so big. So as I grew into being comfortable with who I am and the sort of relationships that I form in the city, you know, it was never a question of hiding my life or my identity or concealing anything. And so I was very confused about why, when I went home, I felt this tremendous oppression almost and this fear of just being natural and normal with the people who probably, in all of their ways, knew me better than anyone else in the world. So that was something that I was grappling with, and so it became a natural thing for me to examine as a writer because it was top of mind. And then as I wrote even more, I found, or I wanted to examine, the almost a metaphorical connection between the silence that I felt internally and then the silence of the landscape that I grew up in, which is so different from, you know, living in a city or traveling to New York or all these places where people are constantly in this, you know, in this space of noise and activity. And I grew up in a place where there wasn't any of that. And so as I wrote, I saw, you know, the connections between my internal silence and the silence of the land. And then finally, as I wrote more, I started to think about, you know, my silence, the silence I carry about my life, is not all that unusual when I think about the people from where I'm from. Because when you have something in your life that you conceal, and you're from a small town, and you have a community where everybody knows everybody, I think that there are a lot more people that hold things very closely and may actually go a lifetime without exploring them or talking about them because of the context that they've always known, which is that small community. And so that then became, you know, this place from where I just started to, you know, for lack of a better word, harvest material. And, you know, over several years, I knitted together the book. So that's where it all came
from. Well, I want to talk about the book, but I want to explore this idea of the prairie and the silence mm-hmm. there, the kind of, you know, not just the physical landscape, but the cultural landscape. I'm thinking about, you know, I've lived in Minnesota and I have family there. Mm-hmm. And I've also, I've read Carol Bly, who's written a lot about mm-hmm. Life in Minnesota, you know, the kind of cultural life. Mm-hmm. And some of it, you know, there's this idea of the Norwegian, Scandinavian keeping things in. You know, maybe that's something that's, maybe it's also related to the, you know, the hard work that people put in when they landed in America as settlers, mm-hmm. immigrants, and they went to these mm-hmm. farms. They had to work really hard. You know, their lives really were not, there was no leisure. There wasn't time to feel things, you know, to kind of go through mm-hmm. the emotional kind of life that modern Americans take for granted. They were too busy. Yeah. They were too busy yeah. surviving and building and just being there. And that seems to, you know, that's kind of created a culture. And I don't want to make it sound like every single person is the same or every single, yeah. you know, no North Dakotan has an emotional language. You would never want
right.
to do that. But there is a kind, you can, there is a recognizable culture there.
Yeah.
In which the cultural language or the emotional language seems to be stopped,
right.
where people do, as you describe it, you know, they don't talk about things that in other mm-hmm. places people talk about every day.
Yeah.
And so what I got a little bit from that for you, and this maybe I'm kind of, it's at the end of the book, which I, you know, because I finished reading it and I've been thinking about that, where you kind of recognize that maybe the silence was coming from you. You're projecting some of it outward. You know, when you met with, you saw your old babysitter and mm-hmm. you came out to them essentially, mm-hmm. her and her husband, and they're, you know, they accepted you. It wasn't that
right.
they, you might have thought that they were going to have problems with you because of who you are. But in mm-hmm. fact, as she said, I've always known who you were.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really profound, because what it teaches you, or what you're teaching us as readers, is that people are more accepting than you realize when you have something that makes you different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a certain, you know, because they know you so well, they don't just reject you and say, you know, because you're who you are, I'm never going to talk to you again.
Right, right. Yeah, you raise a lot of interesting points that I can completely identify and, of course, write about, the notion of hard work and emotion or emotional processing being almost leisurely or something that's, you know, a little too vulnerable. And that is true. That is part of the community and part of the context. And like you said, it's not that every North Dakotan or every farmer, every person from a small town does not process or is not able to talk. But there's definitely an overarching cultural feeling when you're there that, yeah, people are busy. And, you know, my family, I come from generations of farmers, and there's a lot of hard work, and there's just making it through the day, and there's watching the weather and the crops, and, you know, to process feelings or thoughts, that's not necessarily something that I think comes easily when the farmers are gathering in Senex talking about the weather. You know, they're not, and I don't think that they're oftentimes, you know, processing their deepest, darkest feelings or vulnerabilities. But that said, you also raised this thing that I write about or try to examine in the book, which is this fear that I have projected on the people of the small town and my, what I call my extended community, that runs through all of the people in my life that I know in the rural area that I'm from. And every encounter that I had sort of turned the lens back at me. So people were often, you know, the people that I could confide in or the people that I was vulnerable with were often very, very, very accepting and would turn around and actually confide something back in me, something that they had been holding completely unrelated to, you know, my secret or my silence. So that's where I really think that, again, people are holding silences, and oftentimes my willingness, which has been pretty infrequent to date, my willingness to be open has often opened the space for them to be vulnerable and open, you know, back to me. But I would say that one of the underlying sort of lessons that I learned in writing or in spending so much time with this material was that oftentimes our silences are self-imposed, and oftentimes the last soul that we have to sort of reconcile our fears with or our silences with actually happens to be ourselves. And so I think that in the end, that's one of the big overarching points that I ended up making in the book. I didn't set out to make that point, but it's what I discovered through writing and through interacting with the people and through thinking about really, truly what is holding me back and where are my fears. And I think they lie with me and not with others.
Well, no, I definitely felt that you came to that, mm-hmm. and I thought that was actually important. I think the scene where, again, I don't want to give too much away, mm-hmm. you know, that so people should really want to read this for themselves. But when you have this great kind of epiphany with your mother,
mm-hmm.
And there was one place, and I should preface by saying the structure of the book is that you talk about your growing up,
mm-hmm.
In North Dakota, mm-hmm. and what it was like for you and who you were attached to and who your friends were and
right.
kind of some of your suffering as a person who knew she was different,
mm-hmm.
But didn't have a context for that there. But then now, you know, kind of bringing it to the contemporary, you've been living in Minnesota in the Twin Cities for a while, and in the mm-hmm. book you go back home for this 1 month, which is great, you know, where you open the book talking about that, wanting to mm-hmm. drive a truck at the harvest. And so you spend the month kind of hanging out, almost farming, but not quite, and re-experiencing your home. And so
right.
during that time, you know, you have all these kind of interactions with both with family that are pointed and also just mm-hmm. with people who are there. And there's this great scene with your mother where she, you know, and I think you cast it in this way on purpose, but she basically tells you, well, it's really been your problem that you haven't
right.
talked to me. You know, you say to her, we've never talked. We don't talk about this stuff. And she says, well,
mm-hmm.
why not? You know, it isn't me that's stopping you. It's you that's stopping you. And
right.
I thought that was, you know, that was kind of that key moment for you. And you did that well because it wasn't, you didn't feel sorry for yourself, or you didn't, you know, kind of, you know, sometimes people blame their parents and mm-hmm. for everything kind of in, you know, unfairly, you know, we all kind of look back and say, well, I'm this way because my parents didn't do this or they did do that.
Right.
And, you know, I thought you avoided some of that, you know, which was good.
right.
You know, take responsibility for who you are and not, you know, not make it somebody else who's always the responsible party. But I love the interaction with your father, who I thought, you know, he's kind of this quintessential farmer, but
mm-hmm.
he's almost like a Zen character. He lives in the now,
mm-hmm.
you know, the present. He's not
right.
attached. I mean, he's really Buddhist. And
mm-hmm.
I thought that was, you know, the great thing with your emotional attachment to the barn, which is, you know, you recognize in yourself that it's sentimental,
mm-hmm.
and he's a realist. You know, he's got to live there. You're hundreds of miles away, so for you, it's an emotional marker, and
right.
it's a kind of part of your emotional landscape. But for him, it's kind of, well, this barn is in my way, and it's falling down, and it's time for it to go. And he finally does do that. I don't want to give that away either, but I thought the contrast between your view of the barn and
mm-hmm.
his view of the barn was brilliant. I thought that was really good.
Thank you. Yeah, one of the, as you mentioned, going home, and I think that's a good way to describe it, this marker for my farm, or it's just, I have this emotional attachment to the barn, which is the structure that, you know, I think is over 100 years old, and it symbolizes for me the farm and the farm's beauty and a way of life. And yet the thing that's a little bit ironic is that over time, my dad and my uncle, like the actual farmers, in order to be, you know, progressive and successful and to keep the farm going, they've had to modernize. So the buildings that I grew up with as a child, one by one, over time, have been taken down and new structures have been put up. They want to be efficient. They want to, you know, have more space. They want to do things differently. And the barn was the last remaining structure from my dad's childhood and from my childhood. And so I was very much attached to it and didn't want to see anything happen to it. Whereas my dad, like you mentioned, for him, he didn't have that attachment. He very much sees it as a building that needs to come down and another one needs to come up that will, you know, be more efficient and serve the purposes that they need. So yeah, we definitely have had that contrast. And of course, you know, in my greater life, I try to live in the present moment, and I try to not have attachments, and I try to just be in the now. And it was funny for me to sort of discover that my dad, who of course doesn't do all the reading I do about things like that, and who doesn't meditate, and who you know, would think all of that would be probably a little crazy, is actually living sort of those ideals that I have in my life. So that was another interesting thing that I discovered through being there for the month, you know, sort of living the life as a farmer and also then writing about it and reflecting on it.
Yeah, no, I thought that was really good. I mean, you know, because it also contrasts this, you know, the idea, you know, we have in American culture, because farming was so much a part of American life for hundreds and hundreds of years, and it's, you know, there's a kind of almost spiritual belief in the value of farming as a life, but in reality, very few people today want to live that life. Mm-hmm. You know, it's such hard work. You know, as they, you know, that old famous World War I song, "How can you keep them down on the farm once they've seen gay Paris?" You know, nobody wants to live in these, and that's something else. You didn't really talk about this in great detail, but you did portray it in a couple of places, and that is also the what's happened to some of the towns. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know I'm sort of jumping around, but I also love the scene in, I think it was called Cheyenne, where it's a town of 26 people.
Oh, McLeod.
McLeod, the farming town. Mm-hmm. Right, it's near the Cheyenne National Park, I think, or whatever it is. But that it has 26 people. The town is basically a museum. You know, it's, they don't think of themselves as a ghost town, but they recognize that, you know, things are really, you know, things are not what they were. I mean, in the town, I think you, your mother lived in, Windmere, has, you know, it's really, it doesn't have grocery stores anymore. I mean, all these towns are depopulating. And I think that, you know, it really does make you think about the real life of the people who live there versus this kind of emotional view that we have, a kind of sentimental, almost literary view of what farming life is, you know, that a lot of people today who live in cities project onto experience. So you also really did, I think, portray some of that you're now a city person.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go back home, you're bringing your values and your experiences with you. And that's sort of the barn then became that, you know, anchor for you. But it also was the contrast between your view and your father's view of the world.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time when I was home exploring many of the small towns that I grew up around and actually checked out a couple of towns that I had never been to and hadn't ever really thought about the towns or the emptiness in the way that I did on that trip. And I think it was because I went back with more of a I was in my writing mode and writing essence, and so I was taking things in a bit of a different way. And whereas growing up, these were just places with, rundown buildings, and going back and looking at it in a different way, I felt a change. I felt that, these towns will never be populated again. These towns, these buildings will never come back. People are not going to invest in them. Similarly to how Dad is not going to, refurbish the barn. He's going to tear it down. And so that was very, very sad to me. And you mentioned the small town that I grew up near, which is Windermere, and it, I think, probably has the population that it had when I was growing up there. It hasn't changed a whole bunch, but the configuration of the town has. So the businesses have mostly moved to the outskirts, and the main street is, pretty desolate, and the buildings that I even knew as a child are either no longer there or they're vacant. And it's just a sad and almost haunting thing, because it's likely never going to turn around. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about that, writing about that, and also realizing that I am one of the many who actually left. And so there's not a whole lot that I can say about it without being part of the community who, might be there living and trying to change things. And so I'm a little conflicted about that, because I don't know that North Dakota is my life destination, or I'm going to move back to an abandoned small town. But at the same time, I'm very moved by the change and saddened by it.
Well, maybe though, because you have that experience, you become a much better spokesperson, if you will, or a voice for, an understanding of, and trying to integrate the, I think, the real world of farming with the real world of the non-farmer. I think that's actually something that we need. We need a more holistic view of how culture and how, how a modern American life should be. I mean, this is, again, this is kind of really off topic, but I kind of think that the idea of people going from the city to work on the farm, almost the way you did. I mean, I don't want to think of it as these are not, like vacations for rich city dwellers to, like at summer camp farms. I don't mean that at all. But the idea that you spend time working on a farm, finding out what it's really like, demystifying it, but also connecting you to who it is who grows your food, where your food comes from, understanding that. This is a sort of social issue that a lot of people have talked about, that Americans don't know where their food comes from. If you ask them, where does an egg come from, they're going to say the supermarket. And I think that what you can do with and I don't think you set out to do this, but it's a kind of side effect of your life, and that is you can represent both aspects. Your brother, as your brother's taking over the farm, so you're still, your family is still there, and you can be that a kind of connection for them, I think. And it works the other way too. I think when you talked about the idea that when you open up, you create openings there as well. I think that gives you a special role, because you're able to then help. And again, it's not you're not help, doing this on purpose. It's just part of what you're doing to you're changing them. The people around you, you're giving them a new experience of talking about something that they might not have otherwise ever talked about.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Like you said, it definitely is not something I set out to do, but I do realize that I have sort of a unique foot in both worlds. And it became even clearer to me when I started to increase travel for my job to New York, because in Minneapolis, there's obviously a lot of people who have come from Wisconsin or Iowa or North Dakota. So it's more likely that I'm going to run into someone who shares a common background, who grew up in a rural area or on a farm. But in the cities on the coasts, people look at me as if I'm an alien. They really can't believe I'm from North Dakota. And I mean, by the same measure, I have now friends who have lived their entire lives in New York, and I'm fascinated with them and by them and by their way of life, because I can't grasp what it would be like to be inundated with people and noise and traffic and, you know, all of that your entire life. It just feels like they don't have a proper incubation period for, like, silence and quiet. And, of course, you know, they have their own way of achieving that. I mean, a lot of people in the city talk about, you know, when you're on the subway with all the people around you, you actually do experience a similar feeling of tranquility and silence. It's just they cultivated it in a different way. So yeah, I think that there is definitely the bridge between the two worlds is probably thinning, and it probably will continue to thin. And I wrote a little bit about this, but I was fascinated one morning reading the paper and reading about these agro tours that are happening in North Dakota, where you can learn how to actually organize tours to go to, for people to come to your farm and see, you know, the process and where food comes from, like you were saying. And that tells me, I think that says a lot about the gap or the widening gap, because whereas this used to be a way of life for a lot of people, and a lot of people experienced communities where there were farmers and everybody could touch, like, where stuff came from, now I think there's definitely that divide that you speak of. And because of that, I think that people are more interested in trying to learn, but a lot of people will never, you know, probably set foot on a farm or realize or understand where that egg came from. So that's, yeah, crazy.
Well, but some of that is, it does relate to a really profound social and cultural mm-hmm. change, and that is, and you've experienced it in the Twin Cities, it's even true in New York, where there used to be farms very near every city,
mm-hmm.
and all of that farmland has been suburbanized.
Right.
So, you know, inadvertently, without any real intention, you know, without planning, because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't conceived of as a value. And I think you mentioned, or, you know, there are, well, actually, you sort of touched on it, that, you know, the value of the land is seen in its ability to be used economically.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever is the highest and best use, the most expensive gets, you know, gets first shot.
Right.
So farms around the cities have become suburbs, therefore making the distance between people and farm much
right.
greater. And, you know, this actually relates to another book I read recently, which is called Turn Here, Sweet Corn, mm-hmm. which is a woman who had an organic farm outside of the Twin
mm-hmm.
Cities. A long, complicated story about what happened there. But really, it's very difficult to have farms near cities now. And, you know, the suburban towns don't really support farming, and they don't want farms. They don't want tractors
mm-hmm.
and, you know, manure. And, you know, people who have fancy houses near the cities don't want to have a rooster crowing at 4 o'clock
right.
in the morning. So it's really an interesting, not interesting in a good way
right.
either, but it's the agro-tourism idea, I thought you actually treated that kind of humorously
mm-hmm.
in the book, but I suspect it's something that is really almost needed in a way, you know, that people really need to know more. They really literally need to know more. And it also, I think it will create more opportunity for farmers to self-value,
mm-hmm.
you know, in this world where you have so many things working against farmers. I think you need to have more cultural support for them.
Right.
You know, when there's a conflict, you know, somebody wants to put an oil pipeline across
yeah.
farmland, you really want the people who eat food to remember that that's going to affect them on a daily basis. So they should support the farmers who don't want pipelines running across their land.
Yeah, exactly. I think the more you can do to build awareness and to expose people, you know, the better off we all are, because they're also not so much with my folks don't have animals anymore, but more so with animals, like
yeah.
people understanding factory farms and the different ways that you can get your animal products. It's just there's a lot that I think a a lot of good that can come from people understanding the different ways that you can choose to buy, you know, that egg or that piece of chicken, etc. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
So back to you as a writer. So now having, you know, done the first book, the natural next question is, are you, you know, what are you going to write about next, or what are you writing about next?
Oh, that's probably the toughest thing that I found having wrapped up this book, because for so long it was the project, and I had this theme that I was exploring. And so right now I'm actually been writing a little bit more about religion and my experience with it, which I touch upon a little bit in the book. But to be honest with you, I'm waiting for the next big project to resonate. So I've been just working on smaller pieces and essays, and do not have the next project clearly identified. But I hope to soon, because it's a big void in my life not being, you know, completely sucked into something like I was with this book.
So did you write every day when you were writing this book, or is this something, because I know you have a job, you have a full-time job. So, you know, do you write in the mornings, do you write in the evenings?
That has been a huge struggle in my life, to figure out how to balance my need to write with my need to hold a job. And it's been a tension that I've dealt with for years. And so I would say that for a long time I didn't have a pattern. That is, I would write when I was moved, or I'd make time for it, or something hit me, and I would become obsessed with a piece, and I'd do a lot of writing. I also got my MFA, which forced me, I think, to write and gave me some structure. But after that, I sort of went through these spotty periods where at times I wasn't writing for months on end, and that, of course, is very hard and sad when you're a writer, and that's something that really brings the essence of living into, you know, view for you. And so I, about 2.5 years ago, negotiated an alternative work week with my job, where I work very long days, 4 days a week, and I then write on Fridays. So that completely transformed my ability to be productive and to get work done, because what happened is I would write on Fridays all day long as if I was working. So rather than do my job, I was working on my work. And because I did that on Friday, I would naturally return to the material all weekend. Whereas if I hadn't done that on Friday, you know, the weekend might pass and I might not write at all. And so doing that for 2 years really, really helped me make progress both on my book and just make progress in terms of me maturing as a writer. And I also took off a little bit of time. So when I went to the farm, I took a month off where I was back at the farm. And a lot of that time, as I write about in the book, was actually writing. So I would go out to the barn and I would, you know, take wood from the barn, which I read about in the book, really wanting to take pieces of the barn back with me before I was gone. And I would go back into the shop and I would write. And that was the one time in my life that month where I experienced an uninterrupted flow of writing from day to day. Even if I just wrote a little bit that day and was on a tractor the rest of the day, I still wrote. And so I was very happy to see that I could write fast and that I could pump out work and that it improved as I went along. And so I'm eager as I go forward to, you know, continue to carve out big chunks of time where I can write. But it is, for writers who work, and that I think is a lot of writers, it's an ongoing challenge to make writing, you know, get into some sort of cadence where you can return to your writing and make it a part of your life, because it's easy sometimes to allow the pressures of the house and chores and work to overshadow writing. And of course, that's too bad.
Yeah, no, that is I think that's a difficulty. You know, the famous book, Tilly Olson, also, called Silences, which is really about how so many people who haven't had the resources available to them to do their writing or their art, you know, for social and economic reasons, I think it's a, it is a challenge. You have to work. You're not gonna, it's unlikely you're gonna make a living as a writer for most writers. So, it's just, it's a struggle, to be an artist essentially.
It is, yes. And but it makes it sweeter. It's like it's a bittersweet thing in the end. When I in like I mentioned right now, not trying to find my next focus, I really feel it's almost like I'm mourning that topic or that muse or that thing that I'm going to write about, and so I'm anxious to get on to the next thing. But because I have that tension in my life, I think it does make it bittersweet, and in the end, it may improve the work. I'm not sure, but I hope so.
Well, I hope so too. Let me ask just one more question before we're done, and that is, maybe everyone will ask you this, but how does your family feel about this book? I mean, this must be kind of startling in some ways because, I mean, I think, obviously they knew you were writing, but to see themselves in the book, that's hard for people sometimes. And, what do you, I mean, what have they said, and also, what do you really think their reaction is to you publishing this
Yeah,
book?
I think, for again, this goes back to our conversation about I think that the trepidation that I project onto others is really mine. And so for years I kept the material very, very close. And anyone who reads the book will understand that, because my path to be open with my family has taken a long time in terms of just being whole about my life and who I am as a person. So the writing, I let my mom, for example, read a chapter a few years ago, and that was just really hard for me. But now, my family, those who have read the book for sure, they've been very proud and very supportive and very excited. And it's interesting. My mom, who's a big character in the book, there's so much that I was worried about when I handed the final manuscript to her. So much that I wrote about her that I didn't know if she'd be happy with or take the right in the right way, and so much just about my life that I had never talked to her about that I was completely terrified to have her read. And when she came back with her feedback, it was so funny to me that she focused in on the most obscure, strange little details, like a comment I made about, someone having a dirty face, which I revised and took out because she wasn't happy about it. And that, I think, is just that told me a lot. It told me that all of my worries and fears and projections probably are not going to be the places that other people hone in on. And so, in short, I think everybody's excited for me. I think the feedback that I've gotten so far from people in town or in the community is really positive. And so, I think I'll know more as more people, experience the book and read it. But so far, so good. So I feel very, very lucky, because it could have been a completely different experience.
Well, it seems like you have a good supportive network of people around you, and I think it's really great. Well, I want to commend you on this. I think it's a
Thank
wonderful
you.
book. I really, I hope many people will read
Thank you.
it. And thank you for talking to me. This is David Wilk. I've been talking to Melanie Hoffert, whose book, Prairie Silence, a memoir about her growing up and life in North Dakota, published by Beacon Press. Thank you so much, Melanie.
All right. Thanks for the time, David. I really appreciate it.